weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
A huge thanks to Beto da Silva for driving us through the afternoon here on 2FM. It is Tuesday, the 1st of October, and you're listening to Game On with Ruby Walsh and myself, Oisín Coyne. Coming up between now and the new music show with January Winters at 7, Keith Tracy and Mark Langdon will dive into everything happening in the world of football, including last night's drama at Talca Park, Champions League, and some legends of the game announcing their retirement.
In rugby, we'll talk to Neil Tracy as the emerging Ireland side was named ahead of their clash with the Pumas, and in cycling, Shane Stokes joins us to reflect on a cycling season that saw Tadej Pogačar making history and Irish riders making serious progress.
As always, if you want to get your say or have your say, you can text us on 51552, WhatsApp 087 187 9200, or we are on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Well, a very good evening to you. Keith Tracy is with us in studio. Keith, how are you?
Brilliant, Oisín. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. It's been a while since we've seen each other in the freezing cold of the Aviva.
Yeah, it's a lot better in here. Nice and warm, isn't it, in studio?
I tell you where it probably wasn't nice and warm. Talca Park last night.
Yeah, well, it was electric. It really was. It was probably, I had this debate this morning, is it the best game the League of Ireland's ever seen? And for my money, it's right up there. I had a little bit of everything. I had needle within the two teams. There was a few fisticuffs on the bench before Kazim comes on. There was a red card. There was chances. There was some beautiful goals. Brilliant build-up play. Aidan Keane crashes the crossbar with an effort from his own half that probably would have been up there for the Puskas Award. It had a little bit of everything, Oisín. I absolutely loved it. And, you know, for his, you know, so many people will sit here and say Mulroney, El Bouzevi, Brandon Kavanagh, Keane, Mason Melia when he come on. The attacking talent is brilliant for Pats. It's really, really good. It's so exciting. And when you think of Redmond in 1v1 defensive situations in transition, Grigovsky, that relationship is starting to blossom, and Breslin and Mulroney on the left wing, they're getting better with every game I see. I love Solberg as well. 1v1 situations getting better. So there's a lot to love. There really is. And as a Pats fan, I'm looking at them and thinking, can we go and hang on the back of this European race? There's every chance. Some people are even tipping them to go and win the league from here, which with everybody crawling towards the line, I suppose is a possibility. But look, it's mouthwatering stuff. When you think of next season as a Pats fan, my mouth starts to water.
Keith, what about the noise and the atmosphere?
It was brilliant, Ruby. Really, really good stuff. And to be fair, when Pats went 2-0 up, I thought, that's it. Shelbourne can't get themselves back into the game. They don't have enough goals in their team. And all of a sudden, Tullock cuts inside. It's the first time he gets away from Solberg in the whole game. And to be fair, he's only about a yard away from him. It's a lovely little 1-2, cuts inside, and then just arrows one straight into the top corner. And Talca Park just erupted again. And Stewie Bourne on commentary said, this game has just exploded. He was absolutely spot on. And after that, I was absolutely glued to the screen. It looked like shells after Matty Smith's goal, a lovely little straight ball up to Sean Boyd. Matty Smith, little flick through his legs and calls it into the top corner. Another beautiful goal. And just when you think Tullock is going to win it for Shelbourne, he hits it straight at a nine, and a couple of minutes later, Pats go down the other end. Mason Melia, the young boy, I don't know how he does it, wiggles a yard in the box when he seems like Paddy Barra has him, manages to hit the bar, pops back out to Kazim, and he hits the back of the net. Brilliant, brilliant game. Brilliant finish to it. Had a little bit of everything, Ruby, and it was absolutely electric.
Edge of your seat stuff. So Shell's now top of the table, still just 4 points clear of Derry City, who do have a game in hand. St. Pat's now, as you say, maybe still in the mix, Keith. 47 points, sitting in fifth, just two behind Rovers, who are definitely in the title race. But let's hear now from the two men calling the shots last night. A lot of people anticipating what Damien Duff might say. Well, let's hear what he had to say after he spoke to Tony O'Donoghue.
I don't think you win any game of football at any level, giving away the three goals that we did tonight. In saying that, I think the third goal shortly before, there's a free kick given against John Martin when it's a free on him. He's been rugby tackled. I think it's Joe Redmond. Mind-boggling decision. But outside of that, I won't comment anymore. I know other managers in this league are allowed to comment and say what they want about referees. I won't, because I will get a ban. But I couldn't be any prouder of the lads. Yeah, they got back in. The difference tonight, I have to say, St. Pat's, top quality attacking talent. They were stone cold killers. And we weren't, because we got in many, many, many good positions and we didn't take advantage of it. But here, nothing's changed. I'm sick of saying over the last 6, 7, 8 weeks, you know, we're still there. It's still in our hands. Granted, it's another slip up. But trust me, I think you know me by now. I will go till the death.
Yeah, listen, the players, if you said it before the weekend that Shamrock Rovers away, Shelburne away, that you're going to take 6 points and score six goals. But we've been averaging that in all our recent games. So the players are brilliant tonight. I thought Shelburne were very good. They were excellent, you know, to come back from 2-0 to excellent goals from their point of view. They were very good. But to find it away from home, you're on the, you know, receiving end of throwing a two-goal lead away, and then you come back and get the winner. That speaks volumes for the group. There was a lot of good play. Zach down the right for Mason, brilliant, done on his left foot, and then Alamein scoring the goal. So it was a great win to win it.
And Europe must now be on the horizon, though.
I'm not sure. We still have a lot of work to do. You know, I'm not sure it is, but I think from our point of view, you just got to keep winning matches and playing with the freedom that the players are playing with.
Well, that's exactly what they're doing, Keith, isn't it? Playing with the freedom. I think that halfway line attempt yesterday was kind of a symbol of the confidence Pats have at the moment.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think if you're not confident or you're not quite sure how the manager's going to react to you doing things off the cuff in an attacking sense, you don't try them sort of things because, as you say, you're a little bit fearful. But I think what we all know Stephen Kenny will give his attacking players is a licence to go and do things in the final third. The wingers have really come to the party over the last couple of months since Stephen has come into the building, in fairness. Mulroney, it didn't really seem interested under the old manager, and that's not a criticism of the old manager, it's just what I was seeing on the eye. He didn't look too interested, and then El Bezebi came in the building, Ramal Palmer started to do really, really well, and all of a sudden Braddon and Kavanagh, he looks like a, you know, really, really good player. El Bezebi just started to light a fire under me, and looking at him as an old winger, the way he receives the ball, the way he crosses it, and then Mulroney looks across and thinks, yeah, I'm having a bit of that. And all of a sudden Aidan Keane coming into the building gives Mason Mealy a little slap on the bum, saying, well, you're going to have to keep going, although you're a young player and everybody thinks the world of you, there's competition here, and there's an awful lot of competition in that Pats team, which is what I really, really like about it.
That's good to see for Pats, but for Shells, it's squeaky bum time. Away to Rovers, home and away to Drogheda, who are in form, and then up to Derry for the last game of the year. This just looks like it's slipping away from them, Keith.
It does, Ruby. They definitely haven't got any momentum, you know. I'm still reluctant to press the panic button. They got a really good draw against Sligo. I thought they did okay in that game. They had a little bit of an attacking intent, which is what they've been lacking over the last couple of weeks. And then against St. Pat's, obviously, they were 2-0 down, but they showed a little bit of character, got themselves back into the game. They showed there's goals in the team with Tullock and Matty Smith. And look, Sean Boyd's injuries, worries are a big thing for me. I know they've lost Jarvis. Lunny is injured as well. He's a big part of that midfield. Malloy is gone. Moylan is gone. And, you know, it's all just come on top of them at once. But for me, as Damien Duff said, it's still in their hands. It seems from the outside looking in that the pressure is coming on top of them. I'm reading that Damien Duff has shown the boys reruns of Only Fools and Horses to try and lighten the mood. And given the game we got against St. Pat's, I'd be showing them Fawlty Towers next, because more of the same. It was, you know, brilliant, brilliant stuff.
I think he said he was going to be topping up his viewership of Modern Family, rerunning the whole series. But just, I suppose, the sloppiness of Shelburne in the first half, the goals conceded. Now, I was in Tala on Friday and I seen the quality of Pats from set pieces, and Redmond's shown that over the last couple of months as well. But really, the second goal showed those kind of gaps in Shell's defence.
Yeah, and it's fine margins at the very top of the game. Paddy Barrett's little loose pass, you can see what he's trying to do. He thinks he's going to just give it to Wilson. Wilson thinks he's going to clear it, and they're just cutting that, you know, no man's land. Nobody does anything. The Pats player, he's the quickest to react, puts it across the box, and it's an easy tap in for Kavanagh. But when you go back to it, I watched the game this morning, and my initial impressions were that St. Pats were far and away superior than Shelburne. But looking at it back, Paddy Barrett misses a header in around the 12th minute. A couple of minutes later, Joe Redmond goes and scores a goal. So that miss really does go and hurt Shelburne. If you go to the 60th minute, Sean Boyd misses a header. A couple of minutes later, Paddy Barrett makes that mistake and they're 2-0 down. So it is really, really fine margins within the game. So although I'm reluctant to press the panic button with Shelburne, you know, all the momentum, everything seems to be getting in on them. And look, as a neutral, if it can't be St. Pat's, I'd love it to be Shelburne just to mix it up a bit. But, you know, it could be anybody. But, you know, again, I said this last week and I stand by it. Nobody seems to be mentioning Derry, which is crazy given the points totals they all have.
No, well, it looks obviously Shamrock Rovers and Shelburne is this Friday night, the 6th of October, so the League of Ireland will be back on the agenda by then. But Mark Langdon is on the line joining us. And Mark Langdon, just breaking news right now, Bruno Fernandes has won his appeal against the suspension for the red card he got at the weekend.
He has, yeah. Sort of wrongful dismissal. Of course, it was a tackle against James Maddison that I think most people thought should have been a yellow card rather than a red at the time. I understand why the referee Kavanagh actually gave the red card, because it looked worse sort of first time up, but the replay showed that there was a slip and he didn't actually catch him with the studs either. So I think the sort of they swallowed their pride a bit. It was a mistake from VAR not to overturn that, I think. So Manchester United need all the boost they can get at the moment, and I think having Bruno Fernandes available for that difficult trip to Aston Villa on Sunday is definitely that.
Just on the VAR, Mark, like a lot of people are wondering, well, why didn't VAR step in and maybe call it a yellow card? But is a situation where if it's not clear and obvious, or they can't step in those situations, is that why it was given as a red and not changed?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, that you know the VARs have been told not to interfere as much, and that if it's subjective, then to kind of hold back. I suppose that then becomes quite difficult if sort of, I think the vast majority of people felt like it was the wrong decision. I think just continues the confusion, I would say, really, and the messaging around when sort of decisions should be overturned. I think Howard Webb and sort of everyone connected really have got themselves into a mess with this one, because even a subjective call, I think if most people feel like it should be overturned, then I think a referee should be able to step in and just even ask the Kavanagh, you know, go and have a look at this, just make sure that, you know, what you've seen is exactly how it's played out. I think that would have been a really good use of VAR if they would have sent Kavanagh to the screen just to sort of have a second look at it, but we know that they don't even like to do that. So it feels like every week that there's some kind of VAR controversy. And for all that United were outplayed by Tottenham, of course, it was only 1-0 at that stage, and it did have an impact on the game. So United might feel slightly hard done by, but given the way they were outplayed in that first half, probably not the right time to complain about it either, I wouldn't have thought.
Keith, has it surprised you how big a mess football have made of VAR?
I'm not sure it's all of football, to be honest with you, Ruby. I think when you see it within the Champions League and within Europe in general, it works a little bit better, and there'll probably be some shocking decisions on the back of me saying that, but I think the Premier League, we have that grey area, and what Mark is saying there is absolutely right. I was doing the Manchester United game, and as soon as Bruno Fernandes made the tackle, I thought, oh, that's a strong yellow, and then I seen it again and thought, it's just one of those, he's slipping into it and thinks, well, I'm not going to let him go past me, and he just trips him up. There's nothing really in it, it's not a bad tackle whatsoever, and the fact that the referee gives a red card and we're all looking at it thinking, well, that's wrong, but VAR are looking at it thinking, going, well, it's not wrong enough for us to step in. I think that's mental. There's wrong and there's right. There's, well, how wrong do you have to be to actually, you know, get it turned over? And the fact that, why isn't he even sent to the screen? Why not go let him have another look at it? Because I don't know whether that's, you know, code for change or decision. It seems to be, because very rarely will a referee go to the screen and stick with his on-field decision. It's just, yeah, to be honest with you, Ruby, they've made an absolute pig's ear of it. I'm not a fan of it. I think it takes all sorts of the emotion, but you know, the onside offside I think is a black and white one. I don't think there's a lot of, you know, debating them ones, but the subjective decisions where referees can pull a rule out of a book and go, well, that's why I gave that decision. I've never studied the game on a, you know, on an academic level, but I played the game and I know when there's a foul and when there's not a foul, and pulling these rules out of thin air just really, really infuriates me at times.
Just on Ten Hag, Mark, like I was watching the game and, you know, the worst thing about me seeing Bruno get sent off, I was like, this is his excuse now when they do get bet. But like, they're playing Porto now on Thursday. The Dragao is not an easy place to go, especially in a European night. Like, is a loss on Thursday, is that really it for Ten Hag?
I felt there were many times last season when the, you know, it was where if they lose this game, it's all over. And he kind of managed to survive. Then they won the FA Cup. I felt like they'd maybe turned a slight corner as well at parts of this season. Like Crystal Palace wasn't that bad at all, really. If they would have had a striker, I think they would have won that game quite easily. I would say that probably the game against Villa on Sunday would be more defining for Ten Hag. It goes straight into an international break, which is always a troubling time for any sort of coach that's under pressure. And you could argue that Europa League, you know, there's still more than enough games to sort of for United to get their season kind of back on track in terms of Europe. But if they were to, say, get beat in a really high-profile sort of Premier League game on Sunday by a, you know, very well-coached team in Aston Villa, somebody that, you know, I think in Unai Emery's got the ability to, you know, really outthink sort of Ten Hag and all the pace that they've got up front that, you know, was definitely an area of weakness for United last week against Tottenham. Any kind of, you know, heavy defeat, and you struggle to see a way back for Ten Hag. But like I say, I thought that for many times last season, and he just seems to sort of survive and keep hanging in there.
It is a UEFA Champions League night. Salzburg were one up and had that goal disallowed, and are now one down to Brest. And VfB Stuttgart leads Sparta Prague 1-0 in the 5 o'clock kickoffs. But Keith Tracy, it looks a bit of a gimme for Man City tonight.
Yeah, Ruby, I've done a Slobodan Bratislava game, one of the Champions League qualifiers earlier on in the year, and I wasn't too impressed with them. They're a decent, you know, outfit in their own domestic league, but when they step into European level, you know, they're way, way down the ranks. And Manchester City, we all know the strength of them. I'm not sure what sort of team they'll put out, but I imagine that Pep Guardiola and most of the bigger teams within the Champions League will go out and try and get as many points on the board early door so they can take their foot off the gas as they turn around January. So, yeah, I don't expect Manchester City to slip up whatsoever there. Even going away from home, I don't think will be too much of an issue for them. Too strong, too quick on the wings, move the ball way too quickly for Bratislava to stick with them. So I'd be very, very surprised if it's anything other than a Manchester City hammering.
I suppose, Mark, it seems like the goals are coming from, obviously, Haaland, but the defence for City seems to be getting in on the act. Josko Gvardiol seems to be a bit of a striker at underage, maybe, but he's found himself playing left-back now.
He does, yeah, and he showed last season, didn't he, on that title run in how important he can be. And, you know, for Haaland, a fantastic goal scorer, but City will need goals from other avenues as the season goes on, you know. Doku and Grealish probably don't get as many as they should. Foden hasn't been sort of played that much, really. You know, having arrived late, you know, reaching the final of the Euros with England. De Bruyne has been injured, so you will need goals from other sources. They sold Alvarez, and Guardiola is definitely one of those that looks a real big threat. I feel like any of them could score tonight if Slovan play like they did against Celtic on match day one. This could be absolutely embarrassing sort of for the competition's sake. I hope that sort of home advantage means that they're at least able to be competitive. But you know, Celtic absolutely destroyed them, and there's obviously a big difference between Celtic and City. So this could be the widest golfing class, maybe in the whole of the Champions League kind of league phase. Really, you might have the best team in the competition against arguably the worst.
It looks that way. Keith, Arsenal are in London tonight. They have Paris Saint-Germain, and Luis Enrique has left Dembele in Paris after he failed to toe the line at the weekend, I suppose.
Yeah, it's, like I say, as an Arsenal fan, I'm absolutely delighted Dembele is not coming, because in transition, you would imagine that's where PSG are going to be able to hoard Arsenal when Arsenal are prodding and probing and trying to find those holes. If it does break down, his Dembele's pace over the top is a huge, huge weapon. Obviously, the fear factor that PSG once have is gone with the likes of Messi, Neymar, and now Mbappe is the latest to go out the door, although they still have some really, really top-class players. Barcola is a young French boy I really like. Zakir Emery is another really young French boy, very impressive young player. Fabian Ruiz is probably one of Spain's best players in the Euro. So Kolo Muani is probably somebody who'll start on the bench, but he's big, he's strong, he's very, very awkward, he's a handful to deal with. So look, I don't think it's going to be straightforward for Arsenal, but I do expect them to get the job done. And Look, Arsenal for me have just been absolutely brilliant. The one time I started to put question marks over Trossard when he kicks that ball away, I'm thinking, you know, how much do I like him? And then he goes and scores the, well, it wasn't the winner, but he goes and gets a really late goal against Leicester and puts themselves back into the good books. Saliba and Gabriel, you know, what a relationship those two centre-halves have. And I know it's Timber's second full season with Arsenal. He was injured for the majority of the force, but he has just slotted in really, really well. So, yeah, and Saka, you know, I keep looking at him and thinking at some point you're going to have to hit a brick wall and just not play in some of the big games. But he's just so robust and plays well in every game. He seems to get out. And I think Rice in transition, I've already spoke about how good PSG will be on the counter-attack. Rice will have a big part to play in snubbing an awful lot of that out. So really interesting to see how it goes, but I'm just slightly shading Arsenal, Ruby.
Mark, obviously a lot of quality in that PSG side, but maybe not the same as we've seen in maybe the last 4, maybe even 5 years. And obviously they can't get over the line in the Champions League. Is this a real opportunity for Arteta to make a statement? Obviously he's kind of done that in the league, but in European competition.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, PSG away from home were never really a team to trust, even when they had those superstar players. And, you know, last season, Arsenal did well up until a point in the Champions League, came up against a real heavyweight in Bayern Munich. And, you know, I think last season, Arsenal would have considered themselves better than Bayern Munich. But when it actually came to the crunch of the Champions League, they fell short and probably deservedly went out. So this is a game against, you know, an established season Champions League side, one that hasn't got the kind of winning record that Bayern have got, but definitely one that can cause Arsenal problems. But they've given up really on that sort of superstar approach that didn't really do it for them. They did reach a Champions League final and a Champions League semi-final, so they've knocked on the door with all of those superstar players that Keith mentioned earlier. But now it's very much a new team, a young team. Luis Enrique's trying to instill discipline into them. That's why Dembele's not travelled to London. He kicked off after being substituted late on at the weekend. Ridiculous, really, tantrum. And Luis Enrique just had enough and sort of said you dropped. And I think that's a kind of long battle that he's got ahead there, really, because Paris, that dressing room's not been the easiest one to manage probably for a decade or so. But Barcola is, I think, potentially the next one that could be that superstar for PSG, but he's not at the level of sort of Mbappe just yet. So it's not as strong a PSG team in terms of individuals. They might feel like that they're better suited now to play because Mbappe doesn't do anything defensively. He just used to stand around. So they are more of a team now, but they haven't got that fear factor. You know, every time Mbappe gets the ball, he's like a magnet to it. So this is a different PSG. I'm interested to see how they go against Arsenal because it's hard to tell really in France, you know, because they're such heavy favourites every week. So this will be a big test for them as well as for Arsenal.
Sparta Prague have equalised against Stuttgart, but if it's a big test for PSG, it's a massive one for Celtic going to Germany to take on Borussia Dortmund, Keith.
Yeah, huge test, Ruby. And I think with Celtic having beaten Slovan Bratislava in the first game, I wouldn't say a free hit because I think that's a little bit disrespectful to Celtic. They're in the Champions League on merit, so look, just go out there and try and compete. But, you know, we're talking about Slovan Bratislava and Manchester City and the gulf between those two. You know, Borussia Dortmund were in the Champions League final last year. You know, these are going to the latter stages of these European competitions, where a Celtic are, you know, happy to just be competing in it. So look, if Celtic go over there, you know, two clubs that are really renowned for their atmospheres within their stadiums, I think it's great from an Irish point of view. Liam Scales would probably play centre-half. I'd be delighted to see Adam Eade get into it. We might get a bit of team news before the end of the show. But look, we've got a couple of Irish players that will possibly play in the Champions League tonight. So I'll be sitting back with my feet up, delighted to see how they go. But do I expect Celtic to win the game? Not really, but I'd be delighted to see them just compete in it.
But Dortmund come into this one off the back of a bit of a scare. I think it was Friday, 2-0 down against VfL Bochum. They did come back to win 4-2, Mark, but things weren't looking great there.
They really weren't. And that sort of early sort of scare against Bochum followed hot on the heels of them conceding 5 at Stuttgart as well. So defensively, you know, they do give you opportunities. So I think that's the hope for Celtic. They've got relatively inexperienced coach in Nuri Sahin, who used to be a player for them when Jurgen Klopp was the manager, and sort of, he's been entrusted with sort of bringing through a new generation, if you like, because Mats Hummels, the very experienced defender, he's gone. Fulkrug, who was up front in that Champions League run last season, he's departed to West Ham as well. So it's a new team, one that's definitely inconsistent. Would expect them to beat Celtic, because Celtic's defensive record away from home in the Champions League is abysmal. They might be able to score, though. So I think this could be an entertaining game, but you would expect Dortmund to be able to win, and it is a difficult, I don't want to get into sort of cliche territory, but it is a very difficult place to go on European nights. It's one of the most atmospheric grounds in European football, no doubt about that.
Keith, Barcelona face Young Boys tonight, but I don't think that's the big news in Spain at the moment. Andreas Iniesta looks like he's going to retire on the 8th of October because he wears the number 8, but what a career he's had.
Yeah, wonderful player, Ruby. Somebody who, in his prime, I whenever I think of Iniesta, I think of the Champions League final against Manchester United when he was just so elusive, plays 1-2 touch around corners. You think you have an angle where he can't produce a pass, and he just figures out some way to get the ball around you. He's just so difficult, and a real legend of the game. And I think the words world-class legend get thrown around far too easily in today's modern football. But yeah, he's an absolute legend of the game. And I think any young midfielder wanting to learn the game and how to keep the ball and keep the ball under pressure, receive it under pressure, how to play against players that are physically stronger than you, physically quicker than you, go and have a look at him, because he was, as I say, an absolute legend.
Brilliant stuff. Keith and Mark, thank you very much for joining us this evening. Plenty more football talk with Keith and team news from the Champions League throughout the rest of the show. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be chatting to Neil Tracy as the emerging Ireland 15 squad has been named ahead of their clash against the Pumas. Stay tuned.
Game on. Rugby.
Hey, welcome back to Game On. Now, Simon Easterby has named his squad for the first game of the Emerging Ireland's tour of South Africa against the Pumas tomorrow. Neil Tracy joins us on the line, RT sports journalist and host of the RT Rugby podcast. Neil, your initial thoughts on the squad announcement today?
Evening, Oisin. Yeah, well, like, it's a very interesting squad. I think it is probably along the lines of what we were expecting. I think if you look back at the 2022 Emerging Ireland tour and kind of look at the squad that's been selected now, you look back at the time and it seems like it was kind of a dry run to get certain players game time. And I think when the wider squad was announced a few weeks ago, the names that jumped out, obviously Cormac Izichukwu and Sam Prendergast. And I think if you look around at the age profile, some of the other players in the squad, these are probably the two main players that jump out that you want to see over the next week or so. So Cormac Izichukwu starting it at blindside flanker, where he excelled for Ulster in the second half of last season, and obviously went on tour with the senior squad in the summer as well. Sam Prendergast obviously also went on that tour in the summer, still uncapped from a senior level, but obviously starting out half. They are probably the two main players you're looking out for. In terms of some of the other smaller selections there, the more interesting one, Zach Ward out on the left wing is particularly interesting. He's obviously, he was Ireland's star sevens player at the Olympic Games in Paris and was Ireland's player of the year across sevens really all of last season as well. Since then, he's dipping his toes back into the 15s game. Son of a former Ireland international, Andy Ward, as we all know, played a bit with Ballinahinch in the All-Ireland League before he went off to do his stuff in sevens. But he's on a development contract at Ulster now for the next few months, pretty much just on a kind of a trial run, and would have played in the back row, as we said previously. But it's just interesting now that Ulster have obviously seen something in him and Ireland have seen something in him to try him out on the wing. He played in a pre-season friendly for Ulster as well. And I think he's just a player we're interested to see go on the wing, because we haven't really seen too much of him in the 15s game over the last few years.
Neil, there's a good mix from the squads, or from the squads, from the provinces within this squad. I mean, you look at Dara Murray, the Connacht scrum half, you have a Connacht centre and Hugh Gavin with a Munster centre and Sean O'Brien. There's a good mix in players being picked from everywhere here.
There is, and like, to be honest, Ruby, I wouldn't say it's necessarily by design. I think things have actually just fallen into place that way. Like, you mentioned some of the Connacht lads, like Hugh Gavin and Dara Murray and Matthew Devine as well, at number nine. Like, Connacht are producing some really, really promising young players. Hugh Gavin is someone actually as well that we mentioned that I think we would be really interested to see over the course of this season as well, more than anything, because he was one of the real stars of that Ireland under 20 team across the last two seasons that got to the World Championship final in 2023, Six Nations Grand Slam, finished second in the Six Nations last year as well. He played every game across that campaign with the Ireland under 20, still yet to make his debut for Connacht. But when you look at the way Connacht have moved on some more experienced players over the summer, he is a player that even beyond this next week or so, we are going to be seeing a lot more of over the season. Speaking of another Connacht player as well, someone who has a bit more experience in the game is Jack Ainger, a tight head prop. And he's someone I'm really, really looking forward to seeing over the next week or so, because he is probably a little higher up on the age profile than the rest of the squad. A lot of these guys are maybe a year or two out of the under 20 level. Ainger is, I think he's 26 years of age now. He's like, he's played upwards of 50 games between Leinster and Connacht now in his career. So he's well established as a first team player. And it was something that John Fogarty, the Ireland scrum coach, who's over with the emerging Ireland squad at the moment, he was interviewed last week and he name checked Jack Ainger as one of the players they're really looking forward to seeing, because like obviously front rows and you know, creating big, powerful props is something we haven't really done a huge amount of in the country over the last few years. And we're always talking about the succession planning of what happens after the likes of, you know, Tadhg Furlong or Finlay Beelan moves away, particularly a tight head prop. And he's someone who I think has an opportunity to really, really just kind of catch the eye and put himself onto the depth chart when it comes to senior selection for November or into the Six Nations if someone like Tadhg Furlong or Finlay Beelan picks up an injury in the time being.
Just on Zach Ward, Neil, obviously transitioning back from the Sevens game now, is it something maybe the Olympics has paved the way for more players to make that transition, and that will he kind of add a different dynamic to the team now?
I think he'll offer something different. I'm not really sure if we're going to see a big, you know, if this is the way the game is going to go, where there's going to be more back and forth between the two codes. I think even in the last couple of years, we have seen players do that as well. Like Andrew Smith is another player at Connacht as well, who's come from the Sevens programme and went back to Sevens over the summer as well for the Olympic Games. But I think with Zach, it's what you said, it's the potential to offer something different. Now, he's on this trial run at Ulster and it may not work out. He could end up going back to play Sevens, but he has he's, as we saw when he was in Sevens, when he was getting the ball in wide channels with space to run in front of him, he's a very, very powerful runner. And I suppose maybe even though he played back row in his previous time in the 15s game, he probably doesn't have the frame to mix it with the back row forwards that you would see today in the 15s game. But it's one of these things where if it fails, he can still go back and he can be an excellent Sevens player for Ireland. But he has the potential to offer Ulster and, who knows, Ireland within the next couple of years, something a little bit different. And that's just what we're going to find out over the next week and maybe the next few months.
What about the opposition, the Pumas, Western Force and the Cheetahs? What can we expect?
It's always very, very hard to know with these things. You see, the Pumas are coming off, they're probably coming towards the end of their campaign. They're finishing up off the back of a Currie Cup, which was running out right throughout the summer over in South Africa. They finished sixth in the table, won four games. They played Ireland 2 years ago when Ireland were over on this tour as well. Ireland won that 28-24. Now, when you look at the side that Ireland have out here today, it's probably, as I kind of hinted earlier on, it's a little bit lower in terms of experience and age profile compared to what they would have had out a couple of years ago when there was probably more established first team players on this tour. I think really over this next week or so, it probably is just it is a bit of an unknown really what we're going to be expecting. I think the results aren't really what the coaching team are necessarily looking for. Like this Emerging Ireland tour, it's very much just about getting these young players in with the coaches to experience a week in camp or 2 weeks away on tour to get a look under the bonnet and see how they operate with, you know, running the plays that the Irish senior team use, going through the team meetings, seeing who are the players that lead behind the scenes, who are the players that lead out on the pitch, and see who are the guys that are able to adapt themselves to the test environment and who could potentially be able to step up in the next year or so. I think in terms of results, it's not really something they're massively going to be stewing over, win, lose or draw.
Great stuff, Neil. We'll have plenty on that throughout the week. So Easterby side take on the Pumas at 3 p.m. tomorrow before facing Western Force on Sunday and completing their Toyota Challenge against the Cheetahs on Wednesday the 9th of October. And a reminder that there will be a new RT Rugby podcast with Neil Tracy out tomorrow. So to get that wherever you do get your podcasts, it'll be also on the RT website. Neil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On, where we're going to turn our attention to cycling, because at the weekend, Tadej Pogacar became the first man since Stephen Roach in 1987 to win cycling's unofficial Triple Crown. That is, of course, the Tour de France, the Giro d'Italia and the World Championships, which were in Zurich last Sunday. Shane Stokes, cycling journalist with Velo, joins us now. And it really has been the year of Tadej Pogacar.
Yeah, it has been. This is his 23rd win of the season, and he's just been like a runaway train all year. I think what's more notable almost is that he's been dipping in and out of races, so he's been taking breaks. If you totted it right up as to his average, they said Eddie Merckx had, he won something like one out of every three races he started, and I haven't done the calculation yet, but... actually, I can do it right now. Yes, Tadej Pogačar has done 55 days of racing, and he's won 23 times, so that's more than a 50%. Eddie Merckx, at his best, his hit rate was 33 and a third percent, like one third of the races. So, yeah, he's up on Merckx this year in terms of the amount of wins.
And Merckx himself has described Pogačar as possibly the greatest cyclist of all time. Could he be right?
Yeah, he did. He said that after the World Championships. It's an interesting statement, because he hasn't yet at least got the same extent of wins that Eddie Merckx has. So if you're talking about the all-time best in terms of the quantity of victories, then it's premature to say that. But if you're talking about absolute talent, then it can be argued all right. So it'll be interesting to see. It was quite generous of Merckx to say that. You might remember that also this year he was level on Tour de France stage win records with Mark Cavendish, and then Mark Cavendish pulled ahead. So he's seen two of his records equaled or surpassed this year. So it must be a little bit of a peculiar year for Eddie Merckx to see these records falling or being equaled. So yeah, I think Pogačar could, if he keeps his current momentum up, then absolutely he could end up being the best. What's interesting is that a lot of people in the sport reckoned that they would never see an equal to Merckx. That a lot of, particularly Belgian riders, have been described as the new Merckx and were never anything like Eddie Merckx. But now it is conceivable that Pogačar could be his equal or his better, which is very interesting.
I just wanted to pick up there, Shane. You were mentioning the fact that he kind of dips in and out of the races. Obviously, he's come out the back of the GP there in Montreal, and I've listened to a lot of his interviews over the last few months, because these races, they really do take such a toll. Like, you definitely need those kind of gaps in between, and he's lucky in the fact that he can pick and choose that way.
That's right, yeah. And that's a point to make about Eddie Merckx, because Eddie Merckx just raced all year round and achieved his massive amount of victories, notwithstanding a really, really heavy racing programme. So the fashion now is to do lighter amount of races, but to do periods of time at altitude. And I'm sure Pogačar did that before the World Championships as well, and before those two Canadian races, the GP Cycliste de Quebec and GP Cycliste de Montreal. And that seems to be the pattern, that you allow yourself to recover from the intensity of races. You go to altitude, you spend a lot of time at altitude, and then you come back and get back into racing. So, yeah, to do 55 days racing is pretty light, and you can argue that's helped him stay fresh and helped him stretch things out over the year.
55 days might be light, but what about the style of the way that Pogacar rides? I mean, he won six stages in the Giro, six stages on the Tour, and he attacked with, what, 100 kilometres to go at the weekend? He's an aggressive rider.
Oh, he absolutely is, yeah, and he's quite impulsive. What's said is that he loves racing. Indeed, there's an Australian cyclist, Michael Matthews, who trains with Pogacar, and said that he was a little bit burned out with racing and just not enjoying it as much. And then he started training Pogačar, and Pogačar just, he said, thrives on it, thrives on just training in general, just loves riding the bike. And he said that that's become infectious and has helped him rekindle his own motivation for the sport. So I think he just really enjoys what he's doing, doesn't feel pressure. You could imagine, you know, he's got the chance to be the first rider since Stephen Roach in 1987 to take the triple. And on Sunday morning of the World Championships, he slept through his alarm which is I think a pretty good sign of being relaxed. So yeah, he doesn't seem to get stressed. I think he's used to winning and just goes with the flow and isn't under a lot of pressure, and just seems to really thoroughly enjoy what he does, and that shows, I think, in his racing.
I think Ruby picked up there on that 101 kilometres at the weekend, but Manny wondered if he'd gone too soon with it, and I think indeed afterwards he called the attack stupid, did he?
He did, yes, that's right. What was happening in the race was that his Slovenian team was trying to take control of the race from very early on, and the riders on that team essentially burned themselves out by trying to control the race. I think he was down to his last teammate at that point, and just realised that he couldn't control the race any longer. He was frustrated with the other teams not doing their share, I think, and he just launched and did say afterwards that, you know, he was up the road, he was chasing a breakaway. All the big names were behind him and had still had their teams to help chase him down, and he thought to himself, OK, yes, this is a bit stupid. And his two main rivals, Remco Evenepoel and Matteo van der Poel, both said afterwards that they thought it was stupid as well. Evenepoel described it as he thought it was a suicide move. And van der Poel said he thought he was throwing away a rainbow jersey, but it paid off in the end. But I think definitely, Pogačar, there was moments where he was really questioning what he was doing. He was quite under pressure on the last lap. His energy was running out. And I think it was part stubbornness that kept him going to the line. But definitely there was points in the race where I think a lot of people watching wondered had he just done too much too soon.
Well, he hadn't, and he got to the line in front, which is the main thing, to cap an unbelievable year. But there was Irish interest as well. And Ben Healy was one of those riders that was chasing him down.
That's right, yeah. Ben Healy and Tom Skoynes, a Latvian rider, were the two main guys, I think, for a long time, were chasing him. And they were between 40 seconds and 1 minute back, and they rode really, really well together. And, you know, had it not been Pogačar out front, they may well have caught them, and they may well have gone on to fight for the medals. But I think it became evident that they weren't going to get across, and the group behind with Remco Evenepoel, Matteo van der Poel, got back up to them. And notwithstanding all his time out the front, Ben Healy still put in two stinging attacks in the final 7 kilometres, which was really impressive. Each of those were hauled back. The group was riding in a way, I think they were fighting for the medals at that point. So whenever a break went, the other riders did what they could to bring it back. But even so, to be able to do that after such a long race and after being clear for such a long time, I think shows how good a quality rider Ben Healy is. I think what's important is he was away for a long, long time during the Olympics. And he tends to, as much as Pogačar is impulsive, Ben Healy also does the same thing, and doesn't, at least doesn't yet, have anything like the same strength. I mean, he's a very good rider, but I think, you know, few, if anybody, can compare to Tadej Pogačar. I think Ben Healy, his tactics, sometimes he's just, you know, just gone a bit too soon, done a bit too much, even in breakaways. He's done too much of the work. And I think he was cleverer on Sunday, and hopefully it's the start of a new period where he just mixed the talent he has with a bit of tactics, and I think that could bring a lot more success.
And he does have so much talent, Shane. What he's achieved this year, I mean, the sky's kind of the limit.
Yeah, he's very, very, very good, yeah. And I think he's... yeah, I think he can really go on and do some very, very big things in the sport. And he rode the Tour de France for the first time this year and rode very aggressively and could and would normally have won a stage the way he was performing. He was getting in all the breaks. He was getting up the road, getting a good gap. The problem was that there was such a furious battle between the general classification contenders that Pogačar's team, Jonas Vingegaard's team, Remco Evenepoel's team were all chasing, working very hard, essentially trying to burn each other out. But that had the effect of mopping up the breakaways. And there was a couple of times where Ben looked on course for the win, but just was caught on the final climb. So he's really developing very, very well. And I think with the Tour de France and with everything he's done this year in his legs, I think next year could be really good for him.
Overall, Shane, Irish cycling, Archie Ryan was there as well. Eddie Dunbar, 2 wins, of course, at the Giro. He's in a healthy state?
Yeah, at the Vuelta, yeah. That's right, yeah. He had 2 wins right there. Very good in that race. He had a lot of injury issues this year. He crashed in the UAE Tour and had a bad bone bruise on his hand. he crashed in the Giro d'Italia and damaged a cruciate ligament. So he went into the Vuelta a little bit underprepared, hoped for a general classification ride. That didn't happen, but had two really good wins. The first one on stage 11 was absolutely brilliant timing and had the strength as well to hold off the bunch. And then his win on the final mountain stage was absolutely incredible because he really took on the favourites. He attacked close to the bottom of the final climb and held them off all the way to the top. So he's really progressed. He's done wonders for his confidence. I think Sunday's course, Eddie's a little bit of a nervous descender, and Sunday's course it was very tight, very technical. There was a whole lot of descending. He was at the back of the bunch. He hadn't raced beforehand, so I think he was probably just a little bit lacking sharpness, and also the course didn't suit him terribly well, but he still rolled solidly. I think Archie Ryan did really well. He's in his first year as a professional. He was 21st and he'd helped Ben Healy during the race, and I think he's a really, really big talent. He's been very aggressive all year. He took a win earlier this year, and again, I think that he next year will do very well, as will his teammate Darren Rafferty. The three of them, himself, Darren Rafferty and Ben Healy, are all on the EF Education Easy Post team. Darren is also a first year pro. He had a very heavy race program this year, riding the Vuelta a España. Most of the year was spent riding for other people, so you don't see that reflection in his results, but I think the experience he's gained and the strength he's gained is again going to lead to a very good year next season.
Talk to me a bit then, heading into next season. Like, I suppose Eddie Dunbar now and Ben Healy, like, what are the expectations for them after what they've achieved this year heading into next year?
Yeah, I think Ben will go on and definitely be one of the leaders on the team, and I think will challenge for he can definitely challenge for classics, and I think he can become a Grand Tour rider. I think that Archie Ryan is a really, really good climber. I think he's going to be a very classy rider, and again will be a Grand Tour contender. I think he may need 2 or 3 years. He's only 22. He's had a lot of injuries, so he hasn't done as much racing as the other riders. And I think Darren Rafferty as well will again develop into a very very solid rider. And Eddie Dunbar, I think after this year, after his Vuelta performances, Ben O'Connor, who was second in the Vuelta and was second indeed in the World Championships on Sunday, is joining Eddie Dunbar's team next year. I would imagine that Ben will be the leader for the Tour de France, and I can imagine again that Eddie will have his own chances in the Giro d'Italia and possibly the Vuelta a España as well. And I think that, I think all of those four riders will progress next year, and it could be a really rosy season for them.
Shane, just before we wrap it up, it was a disappointing season for Sam Bennett with stomach issues. Are him or his team any closer to figuring out what exactly is up?
I think they're still looking into it. There hasn't been any announcement as yet. And as you can imagine, with medical issues, it's up to them to announce it. So, but they did say that, the Tour de France, his best placing was fourth. Now, you might remember in 2020, he won two stages and won the green jersey. He was going back for the first time since then this year to try and equal that, and fell a bit short. He had those stomach issues. And I believe that the day he was fourth, he was actually experiencing those stomach problems, and he withdrew from the tour the next day because of exhaustion, I think, because he wasn't able to eat on that day. So that same issue hit him in a couple of races since then, and I think if they work that out, that'll certainly go some way towards restoring him to his previous level next year. His health hasn't quite been right the last few years, and I think if he gets on top of that, it can make a big difference. What's interesting is he's got the same coach as Ben O'Connor, the Irishman Stephen Barrett. And Stephen Barrett has obviously worked wonders for Ben O'Connor this year, and I think the potential is absolutely there for the partnership between himself and Sam to be a very fruitful one. So I think if Sam can work out what's going on with his stomach and just have a good solid winter preparation, I think he could be very good next year again.
Well, we wish him the best with that. Shane Stokes, thanks a million for taking our call.
Thank you.
Game on 2FM.
Keith Tracy is just over an hour and 5 minutes away from kick-off in the 8 o'clock Champions League games. Have you any news for us?
Yeah, I've got the Celtic I've got the Celtic team there in Ruby, and Liam Scales is going to start centre-half, but Adam Eda is going to start from the bench. So we've got one Irish international starting there, and the City news against Slovan Bratislava. The good news is it's a weakened City team. Obviously, no De Bruyne and Rodri, Walker and Diaz, Silva, Ederson are all on the bench. But the bad news is the front four is Jeremy Doku, Phil Foden, Savinho and Erling Haaland. So a weakened team for Bratislava, but I'm sure they're still not fancying their chances. And Arsenal's team is unchanged from the team that beat Leicester late on the weekend. It's Calafiori, Saliba, Gabriel, Timber, Rice and Partey as the two holding midfielders. Havertz just advanced ahead of them. Saka and Martinelli on the wings. And it looks like Trossard is going to play as a false nine.
I think it's interesting how, I suppose, with so much emphasis on the fact that Rodri is missing for City. Obviously, it's mentioned Odegaard's out for Arsenal, but they seem to be coping a lot better and maybe using it as less of an excuse.
Yeah, I think so. I think Odegaard is just as instrumental to Arsenal as Rodri is to City. But I think when, you know, we've all seen those win ratios when Rodri's in the City team, when he's out of the team, I think it drops about 15%, which for a team like Manchester City is massive. But look, when you've got, I know the De Bruyne injury is not quite as bad as Rodri, so he should be back soon enough. The Gundogan signing, it looked like a brilliant signing, bringing him back from Barcelona. But now with what has happened to Rodri, it's a brilliant, brilliant signing. And for me, Kovacic is getting better all the time. I don't think you send Kovacic out there trying to do a Rodri drop. You send Kovacic out there to do, you know, to do his own little thing. He's a good player. He can drop the shoulder. He can beat people. But the one thing that Kovacic will do, he'll try and dribble out of defence every now and then, and he will lose the ball. It will put City under pressure. But look, it is tongue in cheek to call that a weakened City team.
Indeed. Well, listen, thanks for this evening, Keith. Loads of happening in the Champions League. And that's it from myself and Ruby. Game on. We'll be back tomorrow evening. Shane Dawson and Alan Cawley will be reviewing all of those games, including looking ahead to tomorrow night's matches. But stay tuned to 2FM as we have January Winters up next with the new music show. And she's all the way through for the rest of the evening. So bye for now. That's it from us.
RTE 2FM.